10 past 8. The morning show with Greg Berg is next. Support for the WGTD Morning Show comes from Jack Andrea, Kenosha's hometown store since 1911. They may be closed, but they have not lost their hometown spirit. You can visit jackandrea.com to shop their exclusive hometown collection, including Kenosha t-shirts, sweatshirts, and mugs. jackandrea.com. The Morning Show is next.
On a couple of previous occasions, I've had the great pleasure of speaking with best-selling author Tom Clavin. I spoke with him about his book Last Men Out, which tells the incredible story of the desperate exit of the last American troops in Saigon at the very end of the Vietnam War. More recently, we spoke about his wonderful book called Dodge City, and very much along that line with Dodge City and another book called Wild Bill comes a book called Tombstone, The Earp Brothers, Doc Holliday, and the Vendetta Ride from Hell. And as you can probably surmise from the title, this book takes us to Tombstone, Arizona, and ultimately to the dramatic events that are known as the gunfight at the OK Corral. It is, of course, an event in our history that is suffused with all kinds of legend and out-and-out fiction. And Tom Clavin, of course, has undertaken quite a challenge in trying to separate fact from fiction and to give us as true an account as possible, not only of that famous gunfight and its aftermath, but also the context in which it occurred in the first place. It's a remarkable book, and it is published by St. Martin's Press. And Tom Clavin, we welcome you back to the morning show.
Well, thank you. I'm glad to be here. I'm glad to talk about Tombstone.
Say a word about your obvious fascination with this particular facet of American history, the Old West. I mean, not that it should be any surprise that it would be of fascination to you and many, many other authors, but what in particular has drawn you to this particular canvas again and again?
Well, to me, I think it's seeing, you know, I should point out that Wild Bill, Dodge City, and Tombstone comprise a frontier lawman trilogy, Tombstone being the concluding book. And what intrigued me is that there's an arc that starts right after the Civil War of how law and order came to the Wild West, how the Wild West began to change from being the Wild West to being a place where people were increasingly settling and building and growing towns so that they could raise families there and build schools, and they built churches, and they had, you know, the local sheriff and marshal became actual police departments. And that didn't happen just by accident. It happened because there were particular figures who made it happen. Early on, you had Wild Bill Hickok, and especially in a place like Abilene, was that first prototype of the lawman, that lone gunman who could shoot faster than the bad guys could. And then you had this, almost like this next generation of young men like Bat Masterson and Wyatt Earp in Dodge City, who found that they really put an emphasis on the word peace and peace officer. They were not there to kill faster than the bad guys did. They were there to make Dodge City a civilized place where people could raise their families, which it is to this day. And then you had Tombstone is where the gunfight at the OK Corral was, to me, a big turning point, because it was this violent confrontation that really represented, the people who participated did not think of it at the time this way, of course, but it really represented the forces of law and order that were on the rise and the forces of lawlessness and the reckless cowboys and corrupt ranchers that were the kind of people that you didn't want to be near your town because you couldn't raise your family there and you couldn't sow the seeds of civilization there. So I saw Tombstone as like a necessary conclusion to that trilogy and to show how the Wild West, for all the good things about the Wild West, also is not going to be a place where people are going to keep settling. We couldn't keep that migration going west until we finally connected with California. So that to me, I mean, let's put aside the fact that I wanted to write a really darn good story that people would enjoy reading and be a page-turner, but I think there's that almost like an epic sense of where we were at the beginning, end of the Civil War, and where we were by the 1880s.
As I think I touched on in the introduction, one of the challenges confronting you in writing about this is the fact that there is so much legend and a fair amount of out-and-out fiction that has sprung up around these colorful characters and these memorable events. And it could not have been easy for you to sift through all of that and try to kind of get at the heart of the story and what was really true. I wonder if you could just speak a moment about the kind of the dimensions of that challenge and how you've gone about trying to tell this story as truthfully as possible.
I don't have a problem with the way that the American West has been romanticized. I mean, I understand it. I'm partly a product of that. I was a kid when you had the shows like The Big Valley and Bonanza and Rawhide and Have Gun Will Travel were popular on television. The shows about Wyatt Earp and Bat Masterson with Gene Barry, for example. And I don't have a problem with that. So I was not doing this because I was on a crusade to set the record straight. However, what I did want to do, and what was a great enjoyment to the working on this entire trilogy, is that when you do dig down to find out what actually happened in Abilene with Wyatt, with Wild Bill, and in Dodge City with Wyatt and Bat, and in Tombstone with the Earp brothers and Doc Holliday, what really happened is as much, if not more, fascinating and interesting and exciting as the legends and the embellishments and the fictions. A big part of For Tombstone that appealed to me is I really wanted to focus a lot on the Earp brothers. So much of the emphasis has always been on Wyatt Earp, but, you know, and deservedly so to some degree. But you had in Tombstone a unique situation where it was a rendezvous point for five Earp brothers. You know, you had Wyatt, of course, but you had Warren, you had Morgan, you had Virgil, you had James, and they were all trying to, in most cases with their wives, they wanted to start over fresh and be businessmen and prosper in this new American West. And yet, you know, the old West got in the way. So to find out more about what Virgil Earp was like, and that he was actually the marshal of Tombstone, Wyatt was not. What was Doc Holliday doing there? How did he end up there? What was his relationship with Wyatt and, by extension, Wyatt's brothers? Who was Warren Earp? Nobody's ever heard of Warren Earp, yet he was there too. How did the OK Corral come about? Was that just an accident, or was it something that was almost inevitable, which I think is true? It was going to happen no matter what. And then the other aspect, which is in the subtitle when it says The Vendetta Ride from Hell, is that Wyatt Earp and the gunfight at the OK Corral probably would have been one of our more famous events anyway in our American history, certainly the history of the American West. But made Wyatt Earp this legendary figure was the Vendetta Ride that took place after the OK Corral. And in this book, in Tombstone, I wanted to give that a lot of emphasis because after his brothers Virgil was shot and his brother Morgan was shot and killed, Wyatt and Doc saddled up, they put a posse together, and they chased down these killers. And that event, that adventure, which went on for weeks and with blood on the trail, is really what put Wyatt Earp into the Hall of Legends that we have.
We're speaking with Tom Clavin about his newest book, which is called Tombstone, The Earp Brothers, Doc Holliday, and the Vendetta Ride from Hell. As you've already touched on, these events in Tombstone, Arizona, in a sense represent the dusk rather than the dawn of the Old West. I mean, this was at a time when America was, in a sense, beginning to lose its frontier, and that, in a sense, the sort of civilized heart and soul of the country was extending everywhere, including places eventually like Tombstone, Arizona. So it's an especially fascinating point in our history in which, in a sense, one era is giving way to another. And I suspect that that has to be one of the most delicious things for an author like yourself to explore.
Yeah, there's a poignance to it because, you know, we've tended to romanticize the Wild West, and some in many cases for good reason. But the Wild West did not last very long. You know, there may be the impression that it went on for decades, and it really didn't. You're talking about 1865 when the Civil War ended and migration west, which never completely ended, but it sort of resumed and more numbers of people loading up wagons and hand carts and saddlebags and whatever, and they're heading across the Missouri River, and they're taking off from points like Kansas City and from St. Louis and Independence, Missouri, and other places, and they're heading west and going farther and farther west. They're going through Texas. They're getting into New Mexico and Colorado. They're getting into Arizona, and you have a they're use the word civilization. That's exactly what they're doing. They're bringing civilization with them. They want to find new opportunities, new places to settle, new geographies, new landscapes, new adventures. The farther west they went, but they're also looking for places that are going to become communities. That are going to be places where they can raise families in New Mexico and Arizona, Colorado. They've already done a good job of populating Kansas and Nebraska and Iowa and places like that. That used to be the frontier. That frontier has shifted to west of the Mississippi, west of the Missouri River, west of the Rockies even. And so there is a kind of a poignance to writing about that change in the American West. It began, you know, Wild West began in 1865. And to me, you know, even though technically you wouldn't say 1881 was the end of the Wild West, you know, there were some other Wild West-like events that took place after that. I do think that gunfight at the OK Corral, which took place in October 1881, between, you know, Virgil, Morgan Wyderp, Doc Holliday, and the Clanton brothers and the McLowry brothers, corrupt ranchers, I do think that definitely represented the end of the Wild West. The Earp brothers were very reluctant lawmen, but that's who they represented. They represented the way law and order had evolved by 1881 against those who would try and stop law and order from evolving.
Right. I like how you say it at one point. Tombstone strained at the bit to become a sophisticated town on the frontier that would attract more investment and families. But you go on to say, like most frontier towns, Tombstone could not pick and choose who passed through and who decided to live there. Ahead of us talking about the conflict that ultimately precipitates this famous gunfight, I want you to talk a moment about another kind of tension that was not exactly the same, and yet I suspect closely related. And that is a fact that there were two very different kinds of people living in this region, some who were drawn there by the big silver strike and looking for riches, and then, you know, apt to move on at the first sign that their prospects would worsen, versus those who came there to settle and raise family and have careers. And I'd never stopped to think about how that was one source of, in a sense, the volatility of the Old West, is that you had people with very different mindsets who probably saw each other with some suspicion, and rightly so.
Well, you definitely had competing interests. Off the top of my head, I could think of three. You had the ranchers and the cowboys who basically wanted the territory to stay open and to have fewer laws and, you know, live free or die kind of attitude, that we don't want civilization to take over. We want to be able to chart our own course. And there is a romanticism to that, and there's an understanding of that and a support for that in a lot of ways. Then you had people who were coming out to the Tombstone area to become successful in business, they wanted to invest in the mines, the silver mines that were producing millions of dollars worth of ore. That's what brought the Earps out there. They didn't come out there to be lawmen and to build churches. They came out there to get rich. And then you had the third competing interest with the people that were there to found and grow these communities. They were not looking to get rich. They were looking for a place that they could be safe and raise their families and put them in the schools that they were building. So you had these competing interests that kept rubbing up against each other in Tombstone, you know, I think more so than pretty much almost any community, at least more so because that was where the gunfight took place in October 1881. You know, there were competing interests all along the frontier, and you could have had a similar gunfight elsewhere, but it didn't happen elsewhere. It happened in Tombstone, and that's why Tombstone is so enormously important to understanding the history of the American West.
Hmm. I want to give you a moment to help us better understand the word cowboy. And I think in the section of your book, which is titled The Cowboys, you open with these words. For many people today, cowboy has a romantic resonance. Countless novels, movies, and television shows have portrayed him as an independent individual who worked hard for his wages, was chivalrous to women, was kind to children, and adhered to a code of honor. They are heroes in most tales of the Wild West, rescuing those in distress and vanquishing evildoers, often with a six-shooter spitting fire. Tell us how this is, at best, an incomplete picture of what people of the time often thought of with so-called cowboys.
Gosh, I wish I was sitting down to write that paragraph again. It ain't bad.
I agree.
Yes, I mean, we've, and again, I'm a product of seeing cowboy movies, let's say, that were released, you know, The Searchers in the late 50s and into the 60s when, yes, cowboy movies began to change. You started to see the more irreverent westerns like Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid and certainly The Wild Bunch. Yet on the other hand, you had still a romanticized version like True Grit, with John Wayne was still making pictures. He even made a picture late in his career called The Cowboys that had this more romanticized view of them. But cowboys in Tombstone and in the period of Tombstone that I'm writing about, they had been chased out of Texas because they had been just too much, you know, illicit activity and cattle rustling and horse stealing and people getting shot, and so the Texas Rangers kicked the cowboys out of Texas into New Mexico, and eventually the government there kicked them out of New Mexico, and they ended up in Arizona. And Arizona is kind of the end of the trail because the next state west is California, and the cowboys are not welcome there. So the cowboys they clung to their way of doing things was that if you needed more cattle and you were too impatient to grow them, you stole them. And if you needed a horse, you stole the horse. And if you had money in your pocket and you went to town at night, you maybe had a little too much to drink and you took your gun out and started shooting in the air or sometimes shooting each other. So the cowboys was the word cowboy was not a compliment in those days. It was a derogatory kind of thing. Oh, you cowboy. You know, you can't do anything else besides just herd cattle on these long cattle drives, which didn't take certainly anything more than an elementary school education and an ability to stay in the saddle for a long time. So, you know, one of the things about my book Tombstone is that I wanted to depict, here's what cowboys really were like in 1880 and 1881, and this is why there was such tension involving them. They wanted civilization such as it was then in Arizona on the frontier to stay the same. Inevitably, it wasn't going to, so that created a great tension and eventually an outbreak of violence.
I think this is a really important time to mention a point you make very early in the book, which is that one of the things we need to discard is any notions of this being about purely good guys, I mean only good guys and only bad guys, that you see a real blend, a real mix. And for all that you just got done saying about cowboys, In fact, you don't want this to be a good guys and bad guys scenario. Explain how it is, in fact, more complicated than that.
Yeah, I'm glad you mentioned that because, you know, for example, the gunfight at the OK Corral can, in a very simplistic way, be seen as good guys versus bad guys. But the Earp brothers and Doc Holliday were not completely good guys. I mean, they basically represented the emerging law and order system, but they themselves had checkered past. I mean, Wyatt Earp had spent time in prison as a horse thief. You know, Doc Holliday was a killer. He had several notches in his pistol, and he was a gambler and an alcoholic. He was not your typical hero by any means. Virgil and Morgan Earp, they had their, you know, spotty past also. And then on the other hand, you had the McLowry brothers and the Clanton brothers. You know, simplistically, okay, they were the bad guys because they were trying to cling to a lawless kind of atmosphere or system for the frontier. But they were good guys in some ways, too. They operated ranches. They employed people. They raised cattle. They raised horses. They were not just passing through. They wanted to establish these ranches there, and they wanted to make that part of Southeast Arizona their home. So it's part of the, to me, yes, an important part of writing Tombstone was to explain that you had people on both sides that were not, you know, homogenous. They, the good guys had their flaws. The bad guys had their good qualities. So it's almost unfortunate that there was this clash at the OK Corral and people were killed because, you know, the people who died didn't necessarily deserve to die, but it was a clash that was unavoidable. You know, not only because of the personalities involved, but the forces that were coming up against each other.
Hmm. As for that gunfight itself, 30 shots in 30 seconds, you tell us, the most famous gunfight in the American West. One of the things you tell us about that is that, you know, we sometimes tend to think of it as the kind of thing that happened all the time. And you tell us that by that point in time, 1881, this kind of thing was exceedingly rare in the Old West.
It was. You know, many of the vigilante and outlaw types that had started to roam the rest of the country after the Civil War, particularly coming from the South. I don't mean to paint the South with a bad brush. It's just that you had a lot of people who had fought for the South, sympathized with the South, and they were finding that the South had become an inhospitable place to live. You know, the Reconstruction was going on. There were Northern troops garrisoned in many places in the South. So you had a lot of these people were heading west, saying, "I'm going to get out of here. I'm going to start over someplace." And there was, you know, they would come up these places on the frontier, which had very few or poorly paid or poorly equipped peace officers, marshals, and sheriffs. So, you know, the rest of 1860 through the 1870s, there, you know, lawlessness confronted this slowly emerging law and order system, so that there would be gunfights. There would be gunfights between the bad guys. You know, they would kill each other. There'd be gunfights between the so-called good and bad guys. But when you get into the early 1880s, something like what happened at the OK Corral was, I mean, the people in Tombstone themselves were absolutely shocked that something like this would be happening in their community, that people would be squaring off, having a duel with each other, that, you know, quick pulling the guns out of their holsters and firing at each other only like 15, 20 feet apart. It was unheard of by that point, yet it happened, and it became the most famous gunfight in American history.
And, of course, in direct contradiction to the idea that any publicity is good publicity, this is the last thing that most of the residents of Tombstone, Arizona, would have wanted for their community. I mean, this is exactly the kind of branding that one would not want if what you hope is that your community is going to continue to grow and flourish as a place of sophistication. I mean, this was a throwback to a violent era earlier that everyone thought had been discarded, and not at all.
Exactly. I mean, two words especially I'm glad that you used in your question was one sophistication, the other one contradiction. Tombstone was really billing itself as a place of sophistication. It was like it wanted to be the San Francisco of the Southwest. And, you know, it was fun to put in the book what some of the restaurants were serving. I mean, you had French restaurants, Italian restaurants. You had, you know, can-can girls. You had performers coming from out of town to perform at the theaters, singing and dancing, and at the restaurants. You had all these recipes and chefs who were emerging with Southwest cuisine via San Francisco and via Los Angeles and via Chicago and Denver. And so they really saw themselves as being this very progressive, on the frontier, emerging civilized town. And the contradiction was, it was also a place where you had the legacy of the cowboy from Texas still very much alive. So, you know, yes, branding, that's the last thing the people of Tombstone wanted. And it wasn't like there was the communities were choosing. They were, to a sense, choosing sides, but not choosing sides to promote a gunfight, of all things. You know, they just wanted one faction or the other to stand down or leave. And no one was more shocked than the population of Tombstone when that gunfight took place.
Mm. Well, your book not only includes a fascinating account of the gunfight itself, but also its fascinating aftermath, which, as you correctly characterize, is a very, very important part of this whole story. The book, again, is Tombstone, The Earp Brothers, Doc Holliday, and the Vendetta Ride from Hell, published by St. Martin's Press, replete with plenty of photographs and the marvelous writing of Tom Clavin. Tom Clavin, thank you so much for giving us yet another wonderful book and for joining me today on The Morning Show to talk about it. Best wishes to you.
Well, thank you. It's a pleasure to talk to you again.
And the time is 8:36. You are listening to the Friday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg, and here is part two and our second author. And we will spend the next few minutes of WGTD's Morning Show with a talented writer by the name of Ed Ruggiero, a West Point graduate, a former Armory officer, someone who has taught leadership skills for the last quarter century or so, with a client list that includes the FBI, the CIA, the New York City Police Department, and other entities, and the writer of 11 previous books, including Duty First, West Point and the Making of American Leaders, and most recently, The First Men in, U.S. Paratroopers and the Fight to Save D-Day. Appropriate, given the fact that 2020 marks the 75th anniversary of the end of World War II. World War II is also the setting of Ed Ruggiero's brand-new novel, which is called Blame the Dead, which is set in a U.S. Army field hospital near Palermo, Italy, in 1943. It is a murder mystery of sorts, but built around the central murderous act around which most of the action revolves, is a very vivid picture of what it is like to be practicing medicine in such a hostile and difficult environment. And there's a lot that we learn from reading this book, which is published by Forge, again titled Blame the Dead. Ed Ruggiero, we welcome you to The Morning Show.
Thanks for having me on.
I'm curious, in this wide-ranging career of yours, when writing became important to you. I mean, is this something you have always loved to do? I mean, from a very young age, or are you a relative latecomer to serious writing?
No, I when I was a kid, I wanted to do two things. I wanted to be a soldier, and I wanted to be a writer. So I've gotten to do both those things, and it's been great. I got one time heard Tom Clancy speak years ago, and he said he'd wait until his 30s to try something that he'd always wanted to do, and, you know, people shouldn't wait. So that, you know, got me moving.
Very good. What about the difference between these highly regarded works of nonfiction around various military topics versus this novel that you have written, Blame the Dead, which I believe is going to be the first in a series of books? What does it feel like for you to shift from nonfiction to fiction? Not that you haven't written fiction before, but are they two very different ventures for you? And what meaning do you derive from writing fiction?
So it's sort of it's a Venn diagram with big overlaps. The common feature is what soldiers are like, how they talk, what they think about, those kinds of things. So a couple of my books are, as you pointed out, nonfiction histories from World War II, and those are based on interviews with probably close to 100 World War II veterans. It's going back a few years. And so I spent a lot of time around these men and got a lot of great stories. I know what's, because of my profession, I know what soldiers talk like, how they sound. And switching to fiction after those couple of nonfiction books just gave me greater latitude to combine stories, to combine characters, and bring to life other aspects of what was going on at the time.
One of the striking things about this book, Blame the Dead, is its setting and the fact that we are given a very potent portrait of what it is like to try to practice medicine under such adverse conditions. First of all, in your experience with the U.S. Army, how much of this did you get to see up close, I mean, in sort of a firsthand way, or is most of what you know about this gleaned from extensive research that you have done?
So I'm not a combat veteran. I served in the 1980s, and so watching things in training and then also based on the interviews of the World War II veterans, I combined those. And I worked with a number of medical professionals, especially from the Army, to make sure that I had gotten those things right. And so I'm grateful to those folks for helping me out. Interestingly, this story, and of course I wrote this at a time when we weren't anticipating this pandemic, but I had a friend reach out to me recently who is, Andrea is an ICU nurse in the Washington area, and she is absolutely on the front lines of this. And she said that she took inspiration from the stories of these nurses in particular, the World War II nurses, who, as you pointed out, worked under these terribly adverse conditions of heat and the threat of violence and the constant flow of casualties and dirt and dust and having to move the hospital periodically to keep up with the fighting. And Andrea found that she was, she said, standing on the shoulders of giants. And of course, in the 1940s, you know, women, not much was expected of women. In fact, it was unusual for women to serve that close to the front. World War II was one of the first times that large numbers of women did that. So I guess Andrea got a glimpse of what her predecessors had been through, and my hat's off to her because she is absolutely on the front lines of this current conflict.
Mm. You happen to go to West Point at the time when it first admitted women. In fact, I think you might be in the class with the first women admitted to West Point, and I suspect that that has something to do with your acute interest in the role of women in the military and what that role has been in history. And of course, even in World War II, we're talking about women being part of our effort even beyond the nursing corps.
Yes. My class, class of 1980 at West Point, was the first class with women. And as I pointed out to an interviewer who asked me about, well, writing about women characters in the military, I said, well, I've been surrounded by strong, smart, athletic, tough women, you know, my whole professional life since I'm 19 years old. So that part wasn't a stretch, and I was glad to see some of my women classmates reacted very positively to the book. Now, of course, even compared to my time in the military, women serve in a lot more roles. They're serving in the infantry, which is where I served, but when I was serving, there weren't any women in the infantry. And all the combat arms are available to them now, and they add, anybody who's been in business knows that a diverse team is going to give you better answers than a monoculture team, and I think the women bring that to bear in the military as well.
For those of you just joining us, I'm speaking with Ed Ruggiero about his newest book, which is a novel called Blame the Dead. This novel is set in a U.S. Army field hospital near Palermo, Italy, in 1943. And the central action of the plot is a murder that takes place there. A doctor is murdered, and a military police lieutenant by the name of Lieutenant Eddie Harkins ends up having to investigate this disturbing act. One of the things that strikes me about the book is that even as somebody who is themselves an Army veteran and obviously somebody who values the role of the U.S. military and thinks highly of it. You're not afraid to create a story set within the military ranks that includes some deeply flawed human beings and a lot of really terrible behavior. And I think there are others who are military veterans who become writers who never quite manage to take that drastic a step and portray members of the military in such honest and unvarnished fashion. Can you just say a word about that? And if there's any part of you that found it difficult to tell a story like this? I mean, I'm so glad that you do. It's part of what makes the story compelling. But it means being honest about the flaws that we see even in the U.S. military.
So in an organization of, you know, World War II, some probably 14 million Americans had a uniform on at one point or another, you know, you're going to get some bad apples. Even in the current military of over a million people, you know, not everybody's perfect. The overwhelming majority of people with World War II and now try to do their job as best they can, their duty as they see it, but, you know, they're human beings. And of course, you know, this is a novel. Blame the Dead is a novel. So, you know, I took some license with this. I've no doubt that, you know, some of these things probably did happen. Fortunately, they're overshadowed by the good that most people did. But a novel about where everybody's wonderful probably wouldn't be very interesting. So there has to be some crime at the center. One of the things I was trying to bring out, so Eddie Harkins was a beat officer, a patrol officer in Philadelphia before the war. He was never a detective. So this gets thrust upon him. He's trying to do an investigation, and he's really not qualified. And one of the things that struck me in all my interviews with the World War II veterans was that these were young people thrust into circumstances they didn't expect, they hadn't anticipated, they had other plans, but they were just making it up as they went along, trying to figure out, well, how can I do a good job, accomplish my mission, and take care of my buddies? And so Eddie Harkins has some of that, where he's figuring it out on the fly, and I've never failed to be impressed by the imagination that young military people bring to their jobs in peace and in war. And that was one of the things that I wanted to bring out, which is why Eddie Harkins is in over his head right from the beginning in this investigation.
Mm. I don't remember if you said that just now in your summary, but he is a former cop from Philadelphia, I believe, which is where you live now. And I think one of the things that's interesting is that what he's doing now in the Army is very similar and yet not exactly the same thing. That is, to be a military police lieutenant is not exactly the same as being a cop in Philadelphia. Can you speak a moment about kind of the difference between the two and the really careful and complicated line he has to walk as a police officer within the military?
So the military police in combat zone do a lot of traffic control and security, and they handle the prisoners. So in the invasion of Sicily, so D-Day in Sicily was July 10th, 1943, and within a couple of weeks, the Allies had poured over 100,000 men ashore and countless vehicles and trucks and wreckers and ambulances and supply vehicles. And Sicily's roads are, there weren't any highways at the time. You know, a lot of just dirt tracks. So one of the things that Eddie Harkins spends a lot of time doing is trying to unsnarl gigantic traffic jams to make sure the right stuff can get to the right place on time. And then suddenly when he's confronted with this investigation, that is just, you know, just comes out of left field for him. And of course he has to work within the military hierarchy, whereas a real detective, say in Philadelphia, can question whomever he or she wants. That's not necessarily the case, you know, in a combat zone where people have other jobs. You can't just pull people out of their jobs, especially at a hospital with incoming wounded all the time. So he's got a lot of challenges. So, of course, in a novel like this, the protagonist always has challenges thrown in front of him or her. That's what keeps it interesting. How are they going to overcome those and get their job done? And Eddie does a pretty good job. He's not without setbacks and frustrations. which are going to play out probably over the next few novels as well.
One facet of this incident that is eventually uncovered involves sexual assault and sexual harassment. And, of course, this is an issue we hear about to this very day. To what extent was this an issue back in the Second World War as well? That's something we really don't hear very much about.
Yeah, so interestingly, the memoirs of nurses that I read and surgeons that I read didn't talk a lot about that. But it kind of defies logic to think you could have that many people in uniform under that much stress and not have something along those lines. But then what I wound up doing is reading records of courts-martial that took place during World War II. Now, the number of American women in uniform was very, very small compared to the number of men in uniform. But unfortunately, GIs did victimize women, local women, wherever they happened to be, not in huge numbers. But, you know, if you're the victim, doesn't matter if you're one of 1,000 or one of 10, it's still horrific. So this kind of stuff did go on. As I said, I took poetic license. It concentrated in this one field hospital. And one of the points I wanted to make was that kind of stuff, when that goes on, that's a failure of leadership. One of the key things you learn as a leader in the military is you got to take care of your people. And if there is harassment, if there is or there are assaults, that means the command is not doing its job, or at least not doing its job well.
Right. And the hospital commander is certainly a flawed individual in a couple of different ways. And he is one of a number of really important, vividly drawn supporting characters that are really an important part of what makes this novel so compelling. What kinds of things did you think about as you crafted specific characters in order to make them real and not yet sort of exaggerated caricatures and so on? I mean, I think you've really done a masterful job, but I'm wondering what the process was by which you created these supporting players, if you will.
So I strive, and I think all writers of fiction strive to make three-dimensional characters, not somebody who just shows up and is a cardboard cutout and only has one dimension or one attribute. Of course, the more time you spend with a character, the more pages they get, the better able you are to tease those things out. So even deeply flawed individuals have other sides to them, and I try to keep that in mind when I'm writing. Writing about women was interesting because, as a man, writing about women who are central to the story, my wife is a huge help in that department. She's my first editor, and then I have an editor at Forge who's a woman, and we had a lot of conversations about how woke can a man in 1943 be without making it seem like he's dropped in from some more enlightened age, or we hope would be a more enlightened age. You know, he has to reflect the common prejudices at the time, but without making him a horrible human being if he's the protagonist. Now, some of the more deeply flawed characters, everybody in the book has some flaw or some problem, and when you're under that much pressure, those things are going to come out. Your real you comes out when you're under a lot of stress, and of course, combat is probably the greatest stressor. So there are opportunities to make each of the characters three-dimensional.
Could you say a word about Nurse Kathleen Donnelly, one of the most significant characters in the book? Maybe this is an opportunity for you to underscore the great admiration which you have for the work that nurses do, something that I think a lot of us find ourselves acutely appreciative of right now, maybe in a way that we have not been before.
So nursing at the time was a woman's profession. Now, of course, it's men and women. We have a young family friend who's an emergency room nurse, a young man. Kathleen Donnelly, interestingly, started out as a minor character, but the more I dealt with her, the more important she became, and the more and it sounds a little strange, I enjoyed her company. And I realized that she could stand in as a representative for all these people who step up to do their job under these very difficult circumstances. early in the U.S. involvement in the war, the government put out a call for nurses to volunteer, women who had already been trained and then could be put in uniform and then moved around the globe to all these places where they were needed. And thousands and thousands of women left, you know, what were relatively safe environments. Kathleen worked at the Pennsylvania hospital to go and get, you know, sign on for who knows what because the country needed her. And there are a lot of scenes where she's stressed out. She's dirty. She's, you know, 26 years old with gray hair. The job is crusher, but she's dedicated. And I was reminded of that dedication. I was reading an interview the other day with, I think it was an emergency room physician in New York City, which right now is one of the hardest hit spots. And she talked about how fearful she is for herself, for her family and all that. But then she had this succinct, beautiful line. She said, but of course, I would never abandon my patients. And I just have always admired that kind of fortitude, that kind of clarity of values. I mean, you see that in soldiers who, you know, I'm going to help my buddy. I'm never going to let my buddy down. And I admire that in the medical people. When I think of Andrea going into work every day with her protective mask on that she's not going to take off for most of the day, I see that same grit and determination that I wanted to create in Kathleen Donnelly.
Hmm. Before I let you go, I want to give you an opportunity to speak to the matter of leadership and what it means to be an able and effective leader in a time of crisis. What would you call on our leaders to do and be at this difficult time for our nation and for our world, for that matter?
Yeah, so I had the opportunity to co-author an article with another former Army guy who's a physician now and runs a hospital system out west. And a couple of the points we wanted to make was that, you know, now is the time to over-communicate, especially if you are removed from your team, you're not in person, you're going to have to try harder, you know, call more often, talk to people. But also, we need to take into account the emotional impact this is going to have. I mean, if you imagine people trying to go back to work after this, when is it going to be okay for me to go to a big office building? Or when is it going to be okay for me to go to, my kid's athletic event and stand around a bunch of people? Folks are going to be frightened, and leaders need to acknowledge that. I don't think anybody expects leaders to have all the answers. Nobody really knows what's going to happen. But acknowledging it, yeah, this has an emotional impact on people. I think that's going to be important. Too often in business, you know, we're so focused on the bottom line or how can we make this process 5% more efficient that we forget we're dealing with human beings. And right now, those human beings, many of them are frightened, rightly so. So I think that's important to take into account.
The novel, again, is called Blame the Dead, published by Forge and the author, Ed Ruggiero. Ed Ruggiero, thank you so much, first of all, for crafting such a fine novel and for joining me today on The Morning Show to talk about it. Best wishes to you. Stay safe.
Yes, you too. Thank you very much.
We want to tell you about the podcast edition of The Morning Show this weekend. Tomorrow, James Shapiro, an expert on William Shakespeare and his book 1599, A Year in the Life of William Shakespeare. On Sunday, because Who Wants to Be a Millionaire has returned to the airwaves, I'm going to replay my 2003 conversation with Joe Kane, a school teacher who Wants to Be a Millionaire as a contestant and had quite a memorable experience there. And we will replay that on Sunday's podcast edition of The Morning Show. You can subscribe via Spotify, Google Podcast, or Apple Podcast. Look for The Morning Show with Greg Berg. On Monday, James Nyberg, film expert, or the author of a number of books about the movies, will give us some suggestions on some great old movies to watch as we hunker down together during COVID-19. And we'll hear from a UW Parkside professor and student about some of what they have experienced in this time of online teaching and learning. On Tuesday, Dr. Art Sear returns to the program for his monthly visit to offer his analysis of all that we are experiencing. On Wednesday, we'll hear how the Hospice Alliance is continuing to offer their important services during this time. Thursday, we'll get an update from Chancellor Debbie Ford from Parkside and President John Swallow from Carthage. A week from today, a look into the mind of Steve Bannon with author Benjamin Teitelbaum. Support for the morning show comes from Jack and Drea, Kenosha's hometown store since 1911. They may be closed at the moment, but they have not lost their hometown spirit. Visit jackanddrea.com to shop their exclusive hometown collection, including Kenosha t-shirts,